You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Your voice matters, and our shows are hosted and produced by students and community members like you. You are CJSF.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we talk about the Liberal government's new Harper-esque budget on The Breach Show. Look back at a 19th century Montreal journalist who advocated for Quebec's working poor on the Broadbent Institute's perspectives, and discuss a new essential read for Canadians who want to advance reconciliation on Red Eye. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. And this episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by the Alberta Advantage Podcast. Based in Calgary, this collective of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from a new episode, the team look at how organized labor in Alberta is responding to an existential threat as the province's teachers are ordered back to work by Daniel Smith's United Conservative Party. Now, here's the show. Makes no
difference. The Alberta Advantage is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. This independent, listener-supported podcast is possible thanks to listeners like you. If you think what we do is important, support us with a monthly donation at patreon.com/albertaadvantage.
And welcome to the Alberta Advantage. I'm your host, Joel, and joining Team Advantage today, we have Roberta.
Hey there.
And Dave.
Howdy.
Today, we're going to talk about the Alberta Teachers Association strike, which took place from October 6th to October 29th. The wildly overreaching Bill 2, Back to School Act, that got rammed through the legislature at the end of it, the use of the notwithstanding clause, and organized labor's response. The province's 50,000 public school teachers were striking for class size caps, which exist in some shape or form in every other province in the country, as well as funding for student complexity in the classroom. If you're not located in Alberta or don't know anybody with school-age kids here, it might be worth saying that 40 students per classroom is now becoming the new normal here, and educational assistants have been basically eliminated under this government. But instead of negotiating in good faith, the UCP government passed legislation that imposes a collective agreement on Alberta's teachers, essentially ending collective bargaining in the province, and prohibits legal challenge, despite the Supreme Court already ruling that workers have the right to strike in Canada. Bill 2 is an existential threat to Alberta workers and others. Labor leaders have threatened to begin the process of organizing towards a general strike 6 years into the UCP regime and to try to defeat the government. So today we're going to talk about the issues behind the strike, the contents and consequences of Bill 2, and what we're seeing from the province's labor leaders.
Alberta has the lowest per student funding in all of Canada. And according to the Fraser Institute, our favorite right-wing institution, they're already not a friend of public services. But even the Fraser Institute admits that average per student funding in Alberta was $13,241 in 2021-2022, while the per student average for all of Canada was $15,771. That's a $2,530 per student difference between funding in Alberta and the Canadian average. Now, those numbers can sound a bit abstract, so let's use a concrete example. For Western Canada High School, which is in Calgary and has about 2,200 students, if Alberta's funding matched Saskatchewan's rate, the school would receive $4,422,025 in total new spending. This would include $2,215,435 in funds available for staffing and 31 new teachers. Matching the national average would bring in almost 40 new teachers for this one school alone, and matching Manitoba's rate would bring in 46 new teachers.
So most provinces in Canada have class size caps. British Columbia has a cap of 30. Manitoba has a cap of 23. Ontario has a cap of 29. Quebec has a targeted average of 23 students. Newfoundland and Labrador have a cap of 34 for high school and lower caps for other grades. Nova Scotia has a cap of 27 for high school. New Brunswick has an average of 25. Saskatchewan has negotiated local caps and targeted averages supported by funding formulas. Alberta has no class size caps or ratio limits. The Alberta Teachers Association estimates 5,000 more teachers are needed to reach the ratios that existed in 2003. This is particularly urgent, largely because of in-migration in response to economic booms. Alberta's population has exploded, and there is significant pressure on the system. Schools are over capacity and require an estimated 200,000 new seats. Alberta also has some of the highest per student funding for private schools. That's public funding for private schools. A student who goes to a private school gets 70% of the public funding that a student in the public system gets. But the school is also charging the parents tens of thousands of dollars a year in tuition. Alberta is the only province in Canada that allows charter schools. Now, the charter system arguably undermines the public education system by producing a segregated educational system. We've done episodes about Alberta's not-so-public education system before, and we'll link to those in the show notes. But overall, it is important to remember that this government wants to expand the private education system at the expense of the public one, and breaking the ATA is an important part of this process.
It's also worth mentioning that Alberta teacher salaries have not kept up with inflation. Teacher salaries have grown 3.8% since 2020, and inflation has grown 19.6%. So effectively, teachers have seen a 13% cut in their salaries at the same time that their class sizes have ballooned, and the number of students with complex needs in those ballooning classrooms has increased, all without extra staffing support. The teacher's contract expired at the end of August 2024, so they've been without a contract for over a year. I think it's fair to say that the core of this conflict is that the government of Alberta does not want to actually contractually commit to the funding required for class size caps or classroom complexity. They might be willing to throw some money at it one year, build a few schools, maybe ignore it the next year, and so on. But if they actually have to maintain a standard for delivering education through class size caps, suddenly the funding becomes very predictable. Based on population growth, you can predict the student population, and then the schools and classrooms, and teachers and student aides necessary for delivering that standard becomes very obvious. This like very obvious funding commitment is very evident. It's just very straightforward math. If you have this kind of cap, if you have this many students, that you divide the number of students by the cap, and that's how many classrooms and teachers you need. It puts public education funding on rails. The UCP doesn't want to do this because it doesn't want to support public education, and it removes their options for playing a shell game with funding. Or saying, oh, we're building more schools, but they're not public. Or, oh, we're funding X thousands more teachers, but that barely keeps up with population growth. The UCP want to avoid committing to deliver quality public education through class size caps, because that means they won't be able to cut education funding when the price of oil and gas yo-yos. It forces the UCP to think responsibly and plan ahead as if we lived in a sensible society. And they don't want to do that. So in May 2025, teachers rejected a mediator's recommendations for a provincial collective agreement, with 62% opposed. In June 2025, more than 94% voted in favor of striking. Summer is not a great time for teachers to strike, however. It's not particularly disruptive, which is the whole point of striking. School began on September 2nd. About a week later, the Alberta Teachers Association announced that teachers would strike on October 6th if a deal was not reached. On September 17th, the government of Alberta launched an ad campaign, public dollars, basically accusing teachers of being selfish and greedy.
Here's Alberta's plan for smaller classes and the best take-home pay in Western Canada for teachers. $2.3 billion to add 3,000 teachers. At least a 12% raise, with many teachers making up to 17%. Now that's a good deal that keeps kids in the classroom.
The ATA went on strike on October 6th. They were locked out on October 9th. And there were 3 weeks of strike action, including some extremely well-attended pro-teacher rallies at McDougall Center in Calgary and in the legislature in Edmonton. There are estimates that these were the largest gatherings in Alberta history.
So the government responds on October 27th, 2025, by introducing Bill 2, what they call the Back to School Act. And they shut down parliamentary debate, did not allow time to scrutinize its contents, and pushed the legislation through in the early hours of Tuesday, October 28th. By a margin of 44 to 37. This was rammed through in all three readings within a few short hours, really just not democratic in any way, shape, or form. And I think, you know, or we think on the podcast here that there's a number of reasons we should be horrified by this legislation. First, it forces the striking teachers immediately back to work and bans further strike actions, imposing fines of $500 a day for individuals and $500,000 a day for organizations. According to Finance Minister Nate Horner, and oh my God, is it hard to say that without vomiting, quote, students need to be in the classroom, end quote. And it's hard not to wonder why then in the 18 months of negotiations between the ATA and the government didn't just give the teachers what they needed. Right. The students aren't the priority here. Really, the government wants to privatize education.
So Bill 2 also requires the ATA accept the terms that 90% of members rejected on September 29th that resulted in the strike. For the record, those rejected terms were 12% salary increases over 4 years, additional market adjustments up to 17%, hiring 3,000 teachers and 1,500 educational assistants, and to create a committee to study complexity in classrooms. And for the record, these are sort of on par with the province has been trying to push on other unions that have seen their agreements come up and be renegotiated. But for the ATA, this imposed contract is set to run from September 1st, 2024 to August 31st, 2028. The government imposing a collective agreement, despite opposition from 90% of employees, kind of seems bad. It doesn't exactly scream free and fair bargaining. The Supreme Court has already ruled that workers have the constitutionally grounded right to strike, accepting the argument presented by the Saskatchewan Federation of Labor in their landmark 2015 case, saying the right to strike is not merely derivative of collective bargaining, it is an indispensable component of that right. Where good faith negotiations break down, the ability to engage in the collective withdrawal of services is a necessary component of the process through which workers can continue to participate meaningfully in the pursuit of their collective workplace goals. The right to strike is protected by virtue of its unique role in the collective bargaining process, unquote. So Daniel Smith knows there is no way the courts don't throw out her unconstitutional legislation, so she proactively prohibited their ability to intervene, stating explicitly that the government was invoking the legislation notwithstanding sections 2 and 7 through 15 of the Charter and Rights and Freedoms, the Alberta Bill of Rights, and the Alberta Human Rights Act. The notwithstanding clause, or section 33 of the Charter and Rights and Freedoms, was included in the 1982 repatriation of the Canadian Constitution and allows a provincial or federal parliament to enact legislation that violates the rights and freedoms of Canadians as long as they explicitly state they are doing so and renew the legislation every 5 years. This is not normal in a constitutional democracy. Rights are rights, or they aren't.
So the myth has it that the notwithstanding clause was the only way to get the provinces to sign on to the new constitution, though we should acknowledge that Quebec never did sign on to that constitution, but that's a whole other conversation. But in reality, Alberta Premier Peter Lougheed's argument at the time was that legislatures, not courts, should be the final arbiter on public policy. The so-called parliamentary supremacy argument ignores the role the courts play in protecting minority rights from the power of the majority in elections and other areas. But in 1982, when this agreement was signed, Justice Minister Jean Chrétien insisted that the notwithstanding clause would be used only as a last resort to, in his words, correct absurd situations. At first, it was believed that the notwithstanding clause would be political suicide to use. But over the years, it has been invoked 16 times, and recently there has been a normalization of its use. Not surprisingly, Quebec has employed it the most, including the 2019 Law 21 banning religious symbols and the 2022 Bill 96 prioritizing the French language. In 2023, Saskatchewan invoked the notwithstanding clause to protect their legislation, quote, requiring parental notification and consent when students under the age of 16 wish to change their preferred names or pronouns related to gender expression while at school, end quote. And also, we should mention the UCP has threatened to use the same notwithstanding clause for similar really disgusting anti-trans legislation. Now, it should be emphasized that each of these invocations represents an instance of the government knowing and expressly forcing through a law that violates the fundamental rights outlined in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Again, this is not normal, but it's becoming more common in Canada.
Does the Alberta Advantage? Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. On this excerpt from a new episode, Desmond Cole sits down with Martin Lukacs to break down the Liberal government's Stephen Harper-esque spending cuts to the public service in the new federal budget in a conversation exploring Prime Minister Mark Carney's failure to address the crisis of affordability and climate breakdown. Now, here's the show.
Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Desmond Cole. The federal Liberal government has just delivered its first budget under the leadership of Prime Minister Mark Carney. The Liberals are calling this a generational budget, and while it might be good for some segments of the corporate economy, there isn't a lot to celebrate for low-income and working people. So what's in this budget, and what could it mean politically for this session of Parliament? Joining us to speak about all of that is Martin Lukacs, the managing editor of The Breach. Hi, Martin.
Hey, Desmond. How you doing?
I'm good. So I want to hear about your experience because you actually went to Ottawa to cover the budget and you did what's called the lockup, a very serious sounding thing that journalists get to do on budget day before all the documents are released publicly, where we get to sit in a closed room, they take your phone away, and you get to kind of peruse this giant document.
Well, actually, they used to take your phones, confiscate your phones, which I was honestly looking forward to, but it turns out now that journalists are allowed to keep their devices, but they have to promise, pinky swear, and sign an agreement that they won't share details of the budget. So basically, journalists go into this budget lockup at 9 a.m. and then it's embargoed, not made available to the public until 4 p.m. when the finance minister delivers it in Parliament. So we get basically a 8-hour head start on the public. It was my first time going. Interesting experience. It all had a kind of symbolic start. I was waiting with a group of journalists near Parliament Hill for shuttle buses to take us to the Diefenbaker, which is about a 15-minute drive away. There must have been about 30 of us, and one shuttle bus shows up with room for 10. So it was like, the Carney cuts, are they already taking a toll? And besides that, you're basically in this room with about 100 other journalists, and civil servants from the various departments are circling, trying to, you know, provide answers to questions that journalists might have, but often just, spinning what's in the budget. And you know, we get this 400-page booklet, which is the budget, very glossy, you know, more in some ways more a PR statement than a clear economic blueprint. And we're allowed to be accompanied by progressive economists. And, you know, in the case of the breach, we brought along a progressive economist from IRIS, which is the progressive think tank here in Quebec, just to, you know, guide us numerically challenged journalists in reading some of the aspects of the budget. Yeah, as you mentioned, generational was one of the big words. Bold, transformational, catalyzing. That's a...
They love that word.
That's one of Carney's favorites for sure. And, you know, the claim of the budget is that it is this, you know, major response to the economic threats coming from the U.S., as well as some of the affordability challenges that we're facing in Canada. But to my mind, it fell far short of all those things. And while, you know, Mark Carney was elected as this savior to defend, you know, the interests of Canada, this budget shows very much that instead he's governing to service the needs of the corporate class. There, it is a budget of corporate handouts and of massive military spending rather than anything to really address unaffordability in this country. And it's the latest sign, I think, you know, beyond the moves that Carney has been making the last 6 months, that what he's really about is redistributing wealth and resources to the already wealthy and the elite. And far from something new, it's really a version of the same old politics we've been getting from conservatives and liberals the last few years. In many ways, it is a budget that Stephen Harper would have been pleased with. And in terms of the cuts that it makes, it matches what Pierre Poilievre had laid out in his own platform. So it is, you know, not something I think that will meet the measure of the moment for Canadians.
Right. So the big feature, I think, of this budget is the massive investments, billions, tens of billions of dollars of new investments in the military, as you mentioned, over the next several years, and the drawback in the public service, about 16,000 public service jobs this year alone, up to 40,000 in the next few years, in order to kind of pay for the new spending in defense and other...
16,000 cuts were already locked in because of measures that have been passed by former Prime Minister Trudeau. And then there's another 30,000 coming in the next 3 to 4 years from Carney. The night before the budget lockup, I was speaking to some people I know within a public service union in Ottawa. And they described an event that happened the week before that really summed up this budget and the way that Carney is governing. So this labor union represents people at the Public Health Agency of Canada, which is one of the departments that has already been facing major layoffs. And the way that layoffs work is it's a kind of like Hunger Games style competition where coworkers basically have to complete a series of tests to compete for the remaining jobs that are available. And the past week, employees at Public Health Agency of Canada had basically been subjected to this, you know, process. And one morning, they showed up to their building, and in the lobby, they discovered a jobs fair in full swing, except it was hosted by the Department of National Defense, which I think gives a very good sign of what the priorities of this government are. They are right-sizing the public service, which is a right-wing euphemism for, you know, making the government far less capable of handling the increasingly complex needs of an aging population, as we have in Canada. And in many ways, it's also, you know, the bulking up this military state is part of, I think, a short-sighted strategy to make defense spending and weapons spending core to our economic growth, rather than, for instance, you know, the care economy or public services and universal social programs that Canadians desperately need in this moment. And there's also, I think, a doubling down on resource extraction, which is far from a transformational thing. It's very much the 19th century economy that Canada stuck with. So in this budget, there's a complete abandonment of a response to the climate crisis and an emphasis on the worst aspects of the kind of rip it and ship it orientation of Canada's economy, with, you know, water guzzling and emission spewing AI kind of thrown into the mix to appease the growing power of big tech. And then it's all wrapped into this, like, you know, nostalgia inducing romanticized notion, you know, settler colonial triumphs on the frontier. We're building big manly things.
I think that there were some pretty clear winners in this budget. And then I think there's like everyone else who either maybe is seeing things that they care about stay the same on flatline in this budget or even be cut and reduced back. Let's start with who obviously won in this budget, who got what they were asking for from the feds, in your opinion.
I think the big winners were the fossil fuel lobby, the weapons manufacturers, and to a large degree, the corporate elite, broadly speaking, in this country, though they didn't get everything that they'd hoped for and been clamoring for. So the departments, for instance, as well, that were protected from 15% cuts were the Department of National Defense, the RCMP, who are getting an injection of 1,000 new cops, CBSA, the Canadian Border Security Agency, who are also getting 1,000 new border officials. And then every other ministry is getting having to find 15% cuts, which will include certainly the, you know, 40,000 public civil servants, but also mean program delivery cuts. And the budget is not very clear about all the impacts that that will have, for obvious reasons, being more of a PR document. I think the biggest winners are, you know, fossil fuel corporations, who are basically being freed from any kind of regulatory obligations. There had been a lot of hoopla about a cap on emissions from the oil and gas sector. This budget makes clear that the Carney government will be abandoning that. They are also rolling back one of the victories of the environmental movement of the last few years, which was a federal greenwashing legislation that would prevent fossil fuel corporations from publishing ads full of disinformation and misinformation about their practices. Mm. And it's hard to see how that has any impact whatsoever on government spending. So that seems just like a little goodie that's being thrown to the fossil fuel industry. There's also new subsidies to liquefied natural gas, which is, despite the government's best efforts to make it seem like it's clean energy, is not. And throughout all of the different program cuts across the departments, there's also $3 billion in cuts to existing climate programs, whether that's public transit or money for tree planting, home energy efficiency. So in many ways, the fossil fuel industry will be very happy with what they got. The weapons industry is probably the faction of the corporate elite who are going to be happiest about this. There's $80 billion in spending, which includes the $10 billion that Carney already announced this summer. That's a 40% increase of the defense budget. And that will mean a bonanza of spending on armored vehicles, attack submarines, weapons systems, on top of what Carney has already committed to warships and jets, not to mention the Golden Dome, which, you know, as we've reported at The Breach, Carney has made it clear that he would likely have Canada participate and pay for that, which would weaponize space and is an absolutely, you know, outrageous boondoggle being pushed by President Trump. And so I think the weapons industry is going to be very happy with this. If there's anything generational in this budget, it is what the government is doing when it comes to military spending in this country. And it really seems like they are putting Canada on war footing, including by encouraging companies, small and large, to engage in what's known as dual use, which basically means developing products that can serve both military and non-military uses. And it really raises the question that when you are putting an economy on war footing, war economies need wars. And that's certainly how Canada's generals, who are probably going to be very happy with this budget, think. They're very tied to the Pentagon. They are, you know, they see our enemies the way the U.S. sees their enemies, namely China. This budget is also about consolidating Canada's role in a U.S.-driven new Cold War against China that will mean a new arms race. And I don't think that's the priorities